Hi everyone, and welcome to season 2 of the Everyday Activist podcast. If you're new here, my name is Eugenia Chow, and I run the Instagram account Eugrenia. The Everyday Activist podcast is founded under the belief that there's no one-size-fits-all approach to activism, and anyone can get involved. For this week's episode, we have Joycelyn Longden, the founder of Climate in Color, an online education platform and community for the climate curious. It stands at the intersection of climate science, social justice, making climate conversations more accessible and diverse. She is also a postgraduate climate research student at Cambridge University, looking to apply AI techniques to climate solutions, namely those that center Indigenous knowledge in the space of forestry and forest conservation. In this episode, we discuss carbon offsets, green colonialism, integrating Indigenous knowledge systems, and how we can best utilize AI technology to address the climate crisis. Joycelyn is truly one of the most knowledgeable people I have come across in the climate space, and I've already learned so much just from following her work and also from attending a few of her workshops. If you don't already follow her work on social media, her handles or Instagram and other platforms will be linked in the show notes of this episode, and do consider supporting her Patreon as well for some extra content or also just to support her work. I really had so much fun recording this episode and learned so much from this conversation with Joycelyn, so I hope that by listening to this episode, you'll be able to take something away as well. Hi, Joycelyn, and welcome to this episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. It's such an honor to have you here, and I can't wait to talk to you today. So firstly, could you please introduce yourself, and how do you describe your work or studies and your environmental narrative?
Cool. So, yeah, I'm Joycelyn Longden. I have just turned 23. I am from the UK. I'm from London, but I'm currently living in Cambridge, where I'm studying for a postgraduate degree applying AI to climate risks. And my specific research research interest is really around kind of disrupting how we work with AI and how we work with AI specifically in the face of climate change and environmental risks, and moving towards a space where marginalized people or people who are Indigenous to place around the world actually have ownership of the technology that is being used, either to better their lives, protect their livelihoods, protect their homes, and protect the environment around them. So that's my focus, really centering those voices, perspectives, and knowledge systems in algorithms and representations, digital representations, for justice, basically for climate justice. And I guess that's my activism through academia. And my relationship with the environment has been a very long one. Even though I grew up in the city, I've had really quite an ingrained relationship with the environment. London is built in zones, going from zone 1, which is right in the centre of London, to zone 5 and zone 6, which are the suburbs, and I'm from zone 5. So I grew up, even though I grew up in a council flat, I still had a big shared garden. We had a brook running behind the garden. We lived 10 minutes away from fields. And so I had that connection to nature and I was obsessed with it. I loved watching, and British people know what I'm talking about, I loved watching Escape to the Country, which is this show about escaping to the country and moving to the country, and I was watching that since I was like 10. And I remember one of my favorite holidays was going to Ireland and just being so amazed at how beautiful nature was there, and so from a young age I've been really connected to the environment and find it a place of solace and of inspiration. Yeah, I feel very deeply connected to the environment, but when I was younger I didn't, I guess, realize what sort of spiritual connection I had with nature and the importance of it to me. I just knew that I loved the outdoors, and didn't have any sort of thinking that I wasn't supposed to be in the outdoors. It was just sort of a natural kind of longing and wanderlust for any sort of outdoor space in nature.
Mm-hmm. Before this podcast episode started recording, you mentioned that you studied astrophysics when you were at university before you started completing your PhD on the more like climate focused side of academics. So was there a specific turning point for you where you realized you wanted to be more involved with environmental issues and climate justice? Or was that something that you had always intended to do?
No, it was something that I had never intended to do. And actually, when I graduated my undergraduate last year, I said I would never, ever do further study. And I said that because of, I guess, like, very low confidence. I didn't think that I would get a good degree because I struggled quite badly with mental health all the way through my degree. And so I didn't think that I'd get the grades. And also I'm not in a financial position where I ever thought that I would be able to afford to go to university and study past my undergraduate, because in the UK you get a student loan for your undergraduate, but you going into postgraduate, you do get some money, but you would also have to work alongside. I wouldn't have ever been able to afford it. But then I got good grades. After I got my grades, I just started thinking, you know what? Let's see what impact I could have, because I was going back and forth thinking, you know, who am I? I don't have to take any action in order to inspire maybe younger generations. But at the same time, I was thinking, wow, like, I have an opportunity here to possibly make a difference in a space where I'm not supposed to make a difference. And am I missing up on an opportunity to provide sort of inspiration or a pathway for people just like me who are younger? That was one sort of thing that went through my mind. And I came across this course and it was funded. And, you know, then there was even more imposter syndrome because it was at Cambridge and it was literally the only course that I would ever see myself doing out of all the courses I looked through, and it was funded. And so it was kind of like the stars had kind of aligned without my wanting them to. So more so to the point of, I was studying astrophysics. I had always been, as I said, interested in the environment. But when I was 16, I went to my first environmental march. And really, that was when I felt quite disillusioned by the climate space. And I felt like I really didn't belong. I felt like the issues that were being spoken about in the environmental movement at the time were not really resonating with the issues that I thought were important. And that's not to say that those issues weren't important in themselves. But I guess when you're seeing people die at the hands of racial injustice, maybe like animal rights isn't just like at the forefront of your mind. Yeah. Not that I didn't care about animal rights, but just that it seemed, some of the conversations within the climate space seemed trivial in comparison to the experiences of, I guess, my community in terms of the Black community in London at the time. And so I didn't feel like, because no one was talking about the intersections of race and climate, I didn't feel like it was my issue. I felt like this is an issue for middle class white people who have the time and the energy to spend campaigning on animals predominantly and not people. And I guess I, as a humanitarian person, I just felt, I guess not, I didn't feel like there was a resonance between what I felt my mission was. And so I focused for like the last 3-4 years predominantly on racial justice. But then as I started reading more, learning more about the colonial past of my people, my parents are from Ghana, so I was kind of doing a little bit more diving, looking into, I guess, the slave history of my ancestors, and slowly joining up the dots between colonialism, climate, capitalism, racism, slavery. And it was kind of like, I don't know if you know that meme where that like woman has this like board of like mathematical equations and like strings, like putting all these things together. And I was like, oh wait, this is literally my issue. Like, this is nothing but my issue, mm-hmm. the climate issue. And although I was dealing with climate on my own personally, like thinking about the ways in which I could be more sustainable, I hadn't up until that point thought that I could personally make a change on a wider scale, or that I should speak about it or should be motivated by it in such a like public way, or in like an academic way. So that was really my motivation, and that was really the point at which things clicked. And I went, and that's when I applied to this course, really with the intention of bringing climate justice, because these courses are, there are so many of my type of courses popping up because governments want to look like they're making an effort in terms of climate action. And I'm very weary that a lot of money is being funneled into research being done by people who are either unawares or are uninterested in actually the experiences, thoughts, and knowledge systems of the people who are really at the forefront. And it worried me to have the training, I have the training that is necessary for this field, but to sit back and watch it being undertaken by people who either consciously or subconsciously may wreak more havoc on marginalized and vulnerable people than intended. And I guess I couldn't sit back and watch that happen. So that's why I'm here.
Yeah. Do you feel like you're currently being well represented in the environmental space, I guess, particularly in your degree in Cambridge?
Well, no. I mean, like, what else do we expect? I think it'd be naive to assume that I would be represented in this space. Mm-hmm. That's really, if I felt represented in this space, and I guess I wouldn't have felt as compelled to be in this space, because mm-hmm. I would feel like there were people speaking on my behalf in this space. So, mixing both the environmental sciences, which is notoriously white and has a notorious colonial history, and then putting that in tandem with artificial intelligence and the technology sector, which is predominantly white and predominantly male mm-hmm. and predominantly neo-colonial. It's unsurprising that there are not a lot of either women or people of colour in this space, specifically black people. Mm-hmm.
So what is the specific programme called?
Oh, it's called Artificial Intelligence for Environmental Risk.
Okay. And so,
have you decided what the specific research topic you're going to pursue is?
Yeah, so the amazing thing about this course and about being at Cambridge is that there are so many resources and it's very interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. So luckily, I have found two really amazing supervisors, and there are actually, even if I'm not represented in physicality, I have talked to quite a few scholars now who are really interested in the kind of work that I want to do and see the importance and are really interested in actually starting conversations around my sort of research interests and the importance of rewriting the oppressive history of both technology and environmental sciences. So I'm really lucky in that sense, and I have people supporting me and trying to formulate this question. So I'm not 100% sure on what my research question is right now, but essentially I think I have whittled it down to I will be focusing on forests, and I will be focusing on using artificial intelligence from a co-created and community-led and centered perspective on forest conservation and actually democratic governance of engagement with forest conservation and protection, which, as we already know, there are so many already indigenous communities who are trying to protect the biodiversity that we have, but are, because of new age sort of protection programs such as the Red Plus UN program and other sort of carbon offsetting programs being actually oppressed and threatened in their kind of in their wishes to protect the land that is theirs and that needs protecting. So yeah, I think that's sort of the way I'm going to be focusing on my research, through looking at smart forests and seeing how I can link all of these sort of realities that I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I watched one of your YouTube videos about how carbon offsetting actually perpetuates neocolonialism.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting. So I guess I was wondering if you could briefly explain how these kind of initiatives often come at the cost of vulnerable people's lives.
Yeah, and I guess I'll just start by disclaiming that, like, a lot of neocolonial behaviours are inherited and are not actually conscious. Now, there are some in this field, in some other fields, like pharmaceuticals and like seed companies, yeah, they know what they're doing. But I think that the issue with such carbon offsetting companies, who their intentions are in the good place, is that we don't talk about colonialism, we don't talk about our history, and we don't embed it into the way that we think about our interactions with people in different localities. So, for example, the Red Program, you can read a book called, let me just get it up, by Nemo Bassi. It's called Stopping the Continent Grab and the Redification of Africa. And it talks about essentially ways in which this Red Program, which is implemented by the UN, and it's called Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation. So it's a conservation project meant to protect forests, but in some localities it's actually ended up in the persecution of forest people, so indigenous forest people in Africa. And it kind of sets the scene for a lot of other carbon offsetting projects that are supposed to protect the forest, but in doing so, remove indigenous people from their lands and actually repurpose their forests to create plantations. So a lot of the time when we're talking about forest conservation, the solution, because of scalability, which is this sort of like climate capitalism where any climate solution needs to be scaled for the global size, then it results in forest conservation turning into plantations. And instead of really trying to work with the biodiversity of the forest, the solution is planting a monoculture or a monocrop of trees in order so that we in the West or in Europe or in America can buy offsets for those trees being planted. So whereas the indigenous communities would have been stewards of the forest, either hunting animals to keep the balance to keep the ecosystem in balance, cutting down certain trees when needs be, lighting forest fires to protect from forest fires, doing all of the traditional activities that look after the forest, companies that are carbon offsetting companies or programs like the Red Program go in and remove those people and plant plantations. And even that sort of plantation, if you even look a little bit deeper into that, it even is reminiscent of our slave period of oppressing people of color in order for this sort of expansive growth of crops and that I think is quite troublesome. There are some carbon offsetting companies that do put people at the forefront and do actually have the benefit of not only increasing biodiversity or soil health through agroforestry, and which allows farmers to also reap the rewards of the trees they're planting because they're fruiting trees, so they can sell the crops as well. So there are alternatives, but I think we just need to be quite observant and critical of the sort of solutions that are coming up and the ones that we engage with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess you mentioned a few
alternatives or like better options to this common form of carbon offsetting, but how do you usually identify this? And is there a better way in which these solutions can be localized? Or do you think carbon offsetting as a principle is fundamentally flawed as like a solution to higher carbon footprints?
Look, I think we are in this stage where we need as many solutions as we can get. I am not against carbon offsetting at all, because there's no one silver bullet to the climate crisis. Not one thing is going to get us out of it. There are so many different industries that will need to provide so many different solutions. And I think that if a company isn't transparent, then I won't trust it. If it doesn't outright say, we are aware of X, Y, and Z, and these are the steps that we're making to make sure that we're not only not perpetuating those things, but actually we are supporting communities. Unless a company says that, I don't trust it, but maybe that mm-hmm. shouldn't be. But I think that the issue with a lot of solutions is that they're being imposed, and that they're being imposed from a Western, Euro or US-centric view. Now, if there was to come a local carbon offsetting company built by the local community who know what the land need, who know how best to deal with that land, and who know the limits of the land, then of course, I mean, that's amazing. And it goes with any other solutions. If they are created either by or in tandem with communities, then I feel like that's a much more sustainable, not just in terms of environmental sustainability, but in terms of community sustainability and the sustainability of the business and the solution and the livelihoods of the people that live there. I think that that perspective should be taken not just in the carbon offsetting sector, but in actually all climate solutions, which is exactly what I'm trying to invoke through my degree, and hopefully if I do it very well, it will create sort of a standard or a benchmark for how we can actually successfully implement co-created solutions with local communities rather than imposing our solutions that might not fit their locality. I think that's the issue with a lot of solutions. We prototype in the West and think that we can just impose them in other localities when it's just not true.
Yeah. So since currently it's mostly the wealthier and like Western countries that are causing like greater rates of emissions and also like a larger part of the climate crisis, do you think that it is a responsibility of these countries to support developing countries and those that don't contribute as much in terms of building like the infrastructure to withstand the impacts of the climate crisis? I guess like to what extent do you think this would be considered imposing in a way?
Yeah, I've thought about this question a lot, and we actually spoke about it at my the Colonial History of Climate workshop that I ran. And I think that the question is quite tricky because I actually have spoken about this question quite a lot. And I think it's tricky in the sense because it's a question that puts the West in this sort of higher power dynamic, and it has mm-hmm. a lot to do with how we perceive development. So to insinuate that the West has a responsibility to support countries elsewhere, it kind of invokes this kind of view of those countries that they are incapable of setting their own future, and maybe they don't want to follow in the footsteps of the West, because the West will only come in with Western solutions. So I definitely understand and think and know it's obvious that the countries in the West, well, not the West, the global North, to be specific, have had a higher impact on the environment, and their responsibility doesn't necessarily have to be shifted abroad. Like we're not doing enough on our own land, let alone somewhere else. So it's that imposition as well of like, again, how in colonial times the colonists would go over and impose their science or impose their knowledge systems on indigenous communities. It's kind of it kind of echoes that a little bit, where it's like, mm-hmm. well, you haven't even got sorted what you're doing over here. And I think that in terms of support, where that can come through is actually allowing talent from Global South countries to write their own futures. So support in that way, either through academia, through funneling funds. For instance, if I get funding for my research, I can funnel that in a way of working with local communities, because they will come under my research funding. So I'm essentially kind of sharing my, or redistribution, the wealth that I have available to co-creating local solutions, rather than me creating something here in the UK by myself without ever talking to anyone in Ghana, say, where my parents are from, and then taking my technological kind of solution over there and saying, you should use this now. I think there's a difference between like that perspective of supporting as in like, oh, we will build the infrastructure for you, and supporting in the sense of, let's work together. What is it that you need? And what is it that you don't have that we can provide? You know, it's changing that, shifting that power dynamic that I think that is important in terms of Global North countries supporting Global South countries. Because one of the biggest supports is actually just reducing the amount that we're emitting and that we're consuming, and the ways in which our supply chains work with Global South countries, not necessarily through more sort of performative collaborations, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for sure. That's really a really good way to think about it, because I'm always troubled by that whole conversation as well. How to prevent like a large scale form of white saviorism in terms of the climate crisis. Thanks. As well.
Thanks. It's the thing, because if you think from a technological perspective, that there is a lot of technology talent in Africa, but in Nigeria, say 90% of their software is imported from the US. And where my parents are from, Ghana, has the Google AI headquarters, which has basically drained a lot of Africa from its technological talent, because of course they're going to go and work for Google. Why wouldn't they? So when we're thinking about support, of course it could be seen as some sort of philanthropic or sort of developmental action for Google to go in there and say, yep, we're going to set up an AI headquarters and we're going to rear the best technologists. But obviously Google has an agenda there. They want to rear the best technologists for themselves, which is a for-profit transnational company, not a company invested in creating localized solutions to the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And so if all of that talent is in Google, then what's left over for actually supporting that community there and not exporting talent elsewhere? I think that's the perspective I'm looking at it through. That how is the support being funneled? How is the support being acted out, and in which, in who is it actually helping at the end of the day? So what is the larger agenda around it? Is it genuinely so that talent and startups can flourish in those localities, or is it about overall kind of agenda for profit or power from a large company?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so like when going about your research and your work, how do you usually apply this mindset of sort of supporting without imposing in a way? Because you're working with the knowledge of Indigenous communities, right?
Yeah, so my actual PhD hasn't started yet. So I'm in my master's phase, kind of. It's like a pre-year to get us all up to speed with like the actual technological side. Mm-hmm. But I'm auditing extra classes in sociology. So one of my supervisors is really a leading figure in terms of sociological discourse. And my other supervisor has worked extensively in African localities. And so I'm really lucky to always be challenged by their writing and by their thoughtfulness around these specific topics and around approaching it from a sense of really co-creating. That's the big difference. It's not my research. It's whoever I am. It's a collaborative research project with other people, whether they be Indigenous or whether they be marginalized communities. And I think that's the difference. I don't own this research. I am being a vehicle for some sort of solution that is co-created with a community to come about. And there are so many critical theories and sociological theories that I'm going to have to really work on before I can even let myself do that. Because I'm very conscious that even though I am conscious about these issues, that I have so many privileges just from being from the global north, that really the way that I approach my research needs to be so intentional and move away from the sort of paternalistic and patronizing perspective that Western research kind of comes under quite a lot. And so it's really about being quiet when I need to be quiet and letting people speak when they know more than me about something, and being more of a vehicle for this research rather than the leader, or rather than, you know, the owner of this research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this reminds me of a recent post that you did about sacrifice zones, and how often when people are discussing the climate crisis, we describe it as an impending doom and not something that's already happening. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the time we say things like, oh, we don't keep the temperature rises below the 2-degree threshold, and then we're going to face like major catastrophe. Whereas in a lot of areas, especially in the global south, they're already facing these environmental hazards.
Yeah.
So how do you think we should better frame the climate crisis? And what do you think is the best way to go about this in terms of wording and also reaching out to different communities?
I think the best way is to not treat it like a universal truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's an issue with Western science, and I was actually reading a paper yesterday called, let me get it up just in case anyone wants to read it. It's called Locality in the History of Science, Colonial Science, Techno-Science and Indigenous Knowledge. And it highlighted this kind of obsession we have, especially in British science, to want there to be this universal truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the climate crisis is very different for so many different people. There's a multiplicity of realities of the climate crisis. The climate crisis looks very different to someone surviving a hurricane than to someone surviving a drought, than mm-hmm. to someone surviving air pollution, than to someone losing their mangrove forests. You know, the world is so rich in terms of diverse experience, diverse localities, and diverse run-ins with environmental hazards and climate change, that I don't think it is. And I did a post the other day about the Anthropocene and maybe mm-hmm. how that sort of universality can be problematic at times. And so I think that the key to talking about the climate crisis is always stipulating in which locality we're talking about. So I can be talking about the climate crisis in London and how that might be presenting itself through disproportionate air pollution in poorer areas and urban heating scenario. But that's not true for someone living in Ethiopia with a quickly declining forest area.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that there is one way that you can talk about the climate crisis that will encapsulate all the different experiences that people have with it, and that and kind of moving away from talking about it as a future event, because it's here. It might not be here for us, but actually I think we're blind to the fact that it is happening in the global north. UK is prone to flooding, really bad floods. People are dying of air pollution. 19,000 people die of air pollution every day. So I think it's even a sort of misconception that maybe it's a reality for people in the global south, but not for people in the global north, because it sure as hell is. With the hurricanes in the US, the out of control forest fires, that is climate change. It's here. Like, it's here for everyone, just in differing extremities. And so I think that the timeliness and the locality within which we talk about climate crisis is really important.
Mm-hmm. So as an academic, what else do you find tends to get left out of mainstream environmental literature or conversation that should definitely be discussed more? At least, I guess, in your context.
Yeah, I mean, of course, everything that we've talked about now, so different systems of knowing, and also society. It seems like in academia, we talk about climate crisis as if it's just like some other phenomenon, like electricity or like gravity. We don't talk about it as if it's actually affecting people. And I don't know why else anyone would care about going into the climate crisis and spending year upon year studying it if you don't care about the fact that people are going to die of it or people's lives are going to be shattered. Well, that's why I'm here. The only reason I want to study these things is because of the impact it's going to have on the human world, the natural world, the environment, the world as Gaia, everything in the world together. And so I think that we really leave out this human aspect. I don't think that the environmental climate science is human enough. And I think that's very sad. That's something that frustrates me. And I think that we don't honour, because we don't honour human experience, we don't honour experience as a form of data or a form of kind of scientific knowledge, which it is. So I think those are the two main things missing from kind of the climate space. Just this humanism is not necessarily always there.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. I feel like when people are passionate about the climate crisis or climate justice, it's not because, it's not like the science so much that compels them to care, but it's because they know its impacts on like communities, about the people and things that are actually more relevant to themselves as well.
Hmm. Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so AI is usually associated with a bit of a complicated ethics where people aren't sure the degree to which they want AI to, I guess, take over their lives.
Yeah.
I guess you talked about this a bit already, but how do you think we can best utilize AI technology in ways that you're studying, but also in other ways to address the climate crisis?
Yeah, I did a post about artificial intelligence on climate and colour. And the main thing to keep in mind is that it's a tool, and that it to some people it seems scary, but actually we've used lots of different scary technologies in the past.
Mm-hmm.
The car is quite scary, or was quite scary. The plough was quite scary. A bicycle, quite scary. All of these things are technology. I think because of our sort of digital-centric perspective of technology, we've forgotten what technology actually is. And it's not just computers. Technology is embedded in a lot of different engineering issues. So that's the first thing that I'd preface it with. The second thing is that it's a tool. It's not a way of life. And maybe some technologists do think it's a way of life, and I think that's wrong. And I think that when we view it as a tool, it occupies a very different reality. I think people are scared because they see how much they're addicted to their phones and their laptops and technology. And that's because AI is being used in the wrong way. AI is being used in a capitalist-centric way. AI has been used in a consumer-centric way right now. AI in the uses of climate it's quite new. It's really cutting edge right now. And the reason that it's been so capitalistic so far is because it's expensive. So who else can afford better to use AI than big companies? And most of the big companies are built on consumerism. And I think that's what people are scared of more than AI. And I think the other thing to notice is that AI has been really attributed to some sort of like sci-fi movie sort of thinking machine. And I think scientists also play up on this fact that scientists benefit from people being confused and mesmerized and not understanding these, you know, complex concepts. And actually, it's not all that. It's very clever, course, and it's very complicated and it's hard, but AI is not some thinking robot. AI takes in a very human focused input. When you're talking about supervised learning in AI, which is one of the most popular techniques, the computer gets trained on data. So, for example, we could look at different leaves on a tree, and maybe we have like a million photos of different tree leaves. And so each photo corresponds to a genus of tree. So we might say this leaf corresponds to a maple tree. So a human has to make all of those labels. The human says this leaf equals maple tree, this leaf equals a fir tree. The computer doesn't do that. The computer doesn't think. The computer doesn't make up those labels. A human does. So all the computer does is learns from those labels. And then when it sees a new leaf, it goes, okay, out of all of the things that I've just been showed and told are a certain leaf, does this one fit in? And then it just, with probability, says, it's most probable that this leaf is a maple leaf because of all the other maple leaves I've seen. So I think it's a misconception. Because it's all kind of a black box and we don't explain what AI is, it seems very scary when in actual fact humans have a lot of control over it. It's really human controlled. And the thinking comes just because of the huge amounts of data that we can input. And it's the very same way that, say, a baby, if you give it a puzzle where you've got like a circle, a triangle and a square, and it needs to put through a circle, through a circle, a triangle and a square, through a square. It doesn't know what a square or a circle or a triangle is, but it figures it out because of all the trials and errors and all the learning. When it sees a circle going in a circle one time, it's more likely to put the circle in a circle again. And so that's the way in which computer science and AI actually really quite human. And I think for me, that takes away it being scary, because actually there is a lot of control over it. And I think that people have been made to be scared. People are made to be scared of doing things that don't make sense. People are scared to do their taxes because it's made out to be very complicated. You're scared to go to the doctor because you don't know what the doctor knows. It's just the fact of expertise in inverted commas that makes you feel scared, because you don't know. And I think that's kind of why I want to be so public and open with the research that I'm doing, because everything looks like a black box, and because scientists aren't that open about what's going on behind the scenes, and it's only for clever people who can understand algorithms that people feel worried. Of course you're going to feel worried if you don't know what is like working behind these things. And although the technology is complex, the concept really isn't, I don't think.
So how do you envision the use of technology, and I guess AI specifically, in the future of climate science?
Well, so there's so many ways it can be applied, and my post went into this as well. So one of the main leading areas is that for decades, we have been using satellite imagery anyway. That helps with weather, it helps with tracking land use. So there's a lot of data from satellites that are traversing the globe right now. And all of this data hasn't actually been able to be used just because of the sheer mass of it, and computer simulations are quite slow, where AI is quite fast and actually thrives under lots of data. So there are so many different ways it can be used. It can be used to track rainfall precipitation and predict sort of floods, or predict droughts, or predict fresh water levels. It can be used to look at land use change. So it can be used to assess many thousands of pictures of different forests and see where forest is being deforested, or calculate the amount of carbon that's being sequestered in a particular part of land. It can be used to assess soil health. It really, any sort of climate science that's already going on right now, AI can be applied to it. If enough data, and if there's not enough compute that traditional scientists are using, then that's where basically AI steps in. So the main use of AI is to analyze data, either classify it. So in the example that I said with sort of trees, so for example, the way you can figure out how much carbon is being sequestered is if you use AI to analyze satellite images of tree canopies and understand the kind of sizes of the leaves in the canopy and then calculate or predict how much carbon that will sequester, how much carbon will be lost if that tree gets logged or burnt down, and how many more trees we might need to plant to sequester a certain amount of carbon. It can be used to predict forest fires. It can look at the different colours of forests that will indicate when a forest fire might be about to happen. It can be used to look at oceanic flows, atmospheric flow. The scope of AI being used for climate change is really quite incredible. And I feel like there will only be more and more uses for it in terms of the fact that we need to act really quickly. And the computer is just way, way quicker than humans could ever be at analysing vast amounts of data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so just to switch gears a bit, you recently shared about a research opportunity that you partnered with Cambridge to offer, the environmental research doctoral training. Could you talk briefly about what this is and what inspired you to create this opportunity?
Yeah, this opportunity is actually at Oxford. It's not at Cambridge. I know it's confusing because I go to Cambridge. But I actually was approached by the new DTP director because she came to my Colonial History of Climate workshop. And they were really interested in, basically, they're a really amazing team and they're really kind of cognizant of the issues within Oxford and are cognizant of the fact that they want to widen participation. And they didn't want to do that from a lens, from an Oxford middle class or white centric lens. They really wanted to bring me, and I'm working on it with Nathan Lawson, who is the president of the Oxford Climate Society, from our perspectives of what we think, or what we know, or what we can understand will be going through someone from a disadvantaged background's mind in terms of applying to Oxbridge, which we both have firsthand experience. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's so important when the environmental space is so, so white and built on such privilege that it is important for people to be represented, not just in terms of people of colour or Indigenous people, but in terms of people from backgrounds that are disadvantaged backgrounds, so people that have been carers or people that have been in care or people that have come from a postcode where they would never really get the opportunity to pursue that sort of research. And I guess it comes from me feeling like I would have wished that had happened for me. Mm-hmm. From a low income black background, being a woman in science, I guess I'm not supposed to be where I am, and it was quite difficult, and I guess it's been quite lonely being where I am. And so to be able to support the university to communicate in a way that resonates with people who would be like me and to understand where their blind spots are, I think is really important for those people who do want to conduct world-leading research. Because we can say what we want about Oxford and Cambridge, but the fact is, if you study here, you have at your fingertips so many resources that you just don't get at many other universities. And it's that because they're such rich universities, the amount of support that you can get, where it is groundbreaking for someone to not have to work and to be able to completely focus on their studies. That's groundbreaking for a lot of people. It's groundbreaking for me. And so I feel like it shouldn't be overlooked how much of a difference just sitting down and talking with people, understanding where it is that they're nervous or that they need more support or that they feel like why they feel like they shouldn't be there. For example, a lot of people in our session that we had earlier this week were asking, I have had to work all the way through university, so I haven't actually had chance to have experience. And you have these preconceptions. Before I applied to my course, it took me 6 months because I thought, there's no point me applying. I don't have a good academic CV. I've never done any research because I've had to work. And actually, the team at Oxford are saying, that shows us more. We're not here to try and get people who have been exposed to opportunity, because we know that there's a discrepancy in who's exposed to opportunity or who has the ability to take up opportunities. And so I think it's really important for people to feel empowered and like that they do deserve to apply for things, and that they shouldn't feel like they're not supposed to be somewhere, and that they're not supposed to belong in those spaces if they want to be in those spaces. And I think that the more doctoral training programs and university courses that do this, just the better. And the Oxford team have not, in the environmental research program, have been absolutely amazing to work with. And give me a lot of hope for the future of environmental research. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I attended your Colonial History of Climate workshop and learned a lot from that. And I was wondering if you intend to host anything similar in the future.
Yeah, so I'm kind of keeping it hush-hush, but hopefully, I mean, if it's listening, there's something coming in the new year. Mm-hmm. And then from that point, I will be doing workshops at a regular interval, because I think people like them quite a lot. And I think it's an interesting way to get information across in a more nuanced way and a more intimate way. So there will be more of that coming soon, and just keep a lookout on the Climate Colour Instagram in the new year for something exciting.
Super exciting. I look forward to that. Okay, so final two questions. First one being, what does being an activist mean to you?
I don't feel like I'm an activist. I wouldn't call myself an activist because I just feel like I don't want to be labelled as anything. Mm-hmm. I feel like I have an issue with me personally being labelled, not an issue with labels in general, but just I'm such a plurality of different things. Like I'm not just a climate researcher. I'm not just a climate activist. I'm a spiritual being. I'm a sexual being. I'm a woman. I'm black. Mm-hmm. I'm a musical being. I'm a creative being. Like, I'm so many different things. And I feel like I'm just human. I'm just someone that cares about things very deeply. I'm also a huge empath, which is, I guess, what motivates me to do, I guess, what is called activism work. Mm-hmm. Wait, what was the question?
Oh no, I guess just like, what does the term activism mean to you, or what does it look like to you?
Yeah, I guess if I were to call it activism, it just looks like living your values, mm-hmm. and taking every opportunity you can to live your values. And that looks different for everyone. Living your values might be being a musician, mm-hmm. and it might not look like what other people think that you should be doing. Living your values might be being an artist and communicating through art. Living my values is using my academic skills to be an activist, or my creative skills. Mm-hmm. I might not necessarily go to a protest. I might not necessarily be shouty on Instagram. I might not do. And that's why I don't want to call myself an activist, because there is some sort of like predisposed criteria, mm-hmm. and if you're not keeping up with those criteria, then you're not an activist. And it's great, because I'm not an activist, so
but
I'm just an individual who has a certain set of values and will always try and use my voice to spread information about those values, whether that's through academia or whether that's through social media. Mm-hmm. And that's what that looks like to me personally.
Oh, I hope it doesn't bother you that this podcast is called The Everyday Activist, because
obviously it's like the point is that it's an everyday activist. It's like exactly what I'm saying.
Okay,
it's like
perfect.
you don't have, people look at activism as if like you need to be doing like what Extinction Rebellion are doing, or you need to be like out in a tree. And it's like, no, you can be an activist in your everyday. Being an activist in your everyday might be actually calling someone out in your workplace for something racist, or for talking to your workplace and saying, oh, could we actually use compostable cups instead of plastic cups? It could be asking your parents to recycle or get a compost bin instead of throwing it all away. Like, I guess I'm against the sort of like gatekeeping definition of activism that puts people in a box and maybe makes them feel like they cannot be involved in climate action because they have to meet certain criteria. And I think that being an everyday activist is exactly the perspective that we need to take on action against injustice.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, because that's the message I'm trying to convey. Just needed to make sure that was clear.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, and finally, for anyone who wants to learn more about the climate crisis or how they can get involved, what are some, you've recommended some throughout this conversation, but I guess what are some specific resources that you'd suggest, or even some workshops, courses, or videos, anything?
So I would I think that I could sit here and recommend a lot of Instagram pages, but I've done that quite a lot on my Instagram page, and actually I think that a lot of our education, Instagram should be a platform for our education. There are a lot of other sites that I think are important. I'd go on Ours to Save, which is a crowdsourced climate publication, and I get climate stories from around the world told by the people experiencing them.
Sorry, what's that?
I would read Ours to Save.
Oh, okay.
I would go and look at Yale Environment 360. I would read the Scientific American. I would read Climate News Daily. And I would try and find local news, local climate news, in your local area to keep involved in what's going on in the climate there. I would also recommend reading a wide range of different books. All We Can Save is a book that just came out by Dr. I would read Braiding Sweetgrass. I would read Future Earth by Eric Holthouse that came out this year. I would read the writings of Rebecca Solnit and of Naomi Klein. I would read Emergence magazine, beautiful articles, online articles and multimedia articles. They also have a course called the Spiritual Ecology course, which I would look into. I would, of course, engage with Climate in Colour and the courses that will be coming up soon. I would look at the Intersection Environmentalist website. There's such a plethora. I could keep going on. I would listen to some podcasts, Outrage and Optimism, the All We Can Save podcast, the Yikes podcast, the Everyday Activist podcast. I would listen to there's a podcast by St. Ethel Burgers, which is a nice connection between spirituality, indigenous knowledge, environment and climate. And I think it's called, I'd also listen to Africa Climate Conversations if you want a different perspective on climate from an actual African-centric perspective. I could literally, and The Future is Beautiful. That's the other podcast as well. There's so much out there.
Yeah.
And I'd read The Drawdown Review.
Oh, yeah. That's what I'd read. Yeah. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to rate and review the show, because that makes a huge difference in helping me get the word of the podcast out.
Also, if you have learned anything from this podcast and want to support the show financially, I would be really grateful if you could leave a one-time or monthly coffee donation through the link in the show notes to support the continuation of this show. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you next Monday.